The last lecture, I gave you an overview of the archaeological evidence as it came to light in the 1930s and 1940s, to give you an idea of why there was a tremendous movement away from the traditional dating for the Exodus and the Conquest. And what I've done is to reassemble the information we had on the chart last time, with adding a number of additional columns so that you can collate additional information more easily rather than having separate charts. It can all be there together on one chart. And we saw that if we listed 14 cities intimately connected with the biblical account of the conquest, Arad, Horma, those two cities that figured in the attack of the king of Arad against the Israelites, which is mentioned in Numbers chapter 21, even while they were still yet under the leadership of Moses. And then Heshbon, in the capital of the king of Zion, king of the Amorites, in his kingdom east of the Jordan River. Again, Moses was still in command at that time. Then we move on, number four, we'll begin to come under Joshua's leadership to Jericho and Ai and Gibeon. And then the alliance of Canaanite cities that made war on Gibeon because they made peace with Israel: Jerusalem, Hebron, Debir, Lachish, and Yarmuth. And then two other cities that are mentioned as being destroyed by Joshua in Joshua chapter 10 in the consequence of his campaign to save the people of Gibeon: Libna and Eglon. And then finally, the city which is specifically mentioned in connection with Joshua's activity in the north as being burned, the city of Hazor. So we have a list of 14 cities. Repeating them again: Arad, Horma, Heshbon, Jericho, and Ai, Gibeon, then Jerusalem, Hebron, Debir, Lachish, Yarmuth, Libna, Eglon, and Hazor. And that if we take a look, as archaeology has presented and organized the evidence, as to which of these cities fits this biblical description, if we put the conquest at 1400 B.C. in what is known as, by conventional dating, as the Late Bronze One, the end of the Late Bronze One period, there was no city of Arad, there was no city of Horma, there was no city of Heshbon. Jericho, instead of coming to a great destruction, continued to exist without interruption throughout this period. There was no Ai, there was no Gibeon. Finally, when we get down to number seven in the list, we get a match. Jerusalem did exist. So in your map manuals, you'll notice on the maps that show this period, there is no dot and name for Jerusalem. That's because until the excavations in the city of David under Professor Shiloh, which our students assisted at, there was no archaeological evidence for any existence of material in Jerusalem in the Late Bronze Age at all. That's how recent it is that we've even proved Jerusalem existed in the Late Bronze Age. So it shows you this picture is constantly changing, you know, as archaeology proceeds. So we get the first hit with Jerusalem. Hebron did not exist. Debir did not exist in the Late Bronze One Age. Lachish did. Okay, again a hit, and it seems it might have been destroyed at this time. Question marks for Yarmuth and Libna and Eglon, because we're not sure we have found the appropriate sites, and even the ones that are suggested for these three sites have only undergone minimal excavation. And so therefore, you could not make a definitive conclusion even there. And finally, at Hazor, definitely there is a city that was destroyed at that time. So you can understand by looking at this chart why it is people begin to say, hey, wait a minute, maybe we're looking in the wrong place. And then, of course, last time we traced the reasons why they began to look in the late 13th century B.C., around 1225 B.C., and Albright, of course, leading the way and others joining on his bandwagon, not the least because Albright was so famous that, it was natural for people to join that bandwagon. Indeed, I want to quote extensively from an article that was written by Yigal Yadin. Yigal Yadin, or Yigal, I should say, is pronounced his name properly, was, until his death, probably the leading or one of the leading Israeli archaeologists. Certainly, Dr. Mazar is still considered the dean among the Israeli archaeologists, but after him, probably, while they were yet alive, Aharoni and Yadin were the two most prominent men in the field who were Israelis. Both Yadin and Aharoni are now dead, both dying prematurely, probably this is a great loss to the field because of their industry. I will say their industry rather than their conclusions. All right, I'm reading from an article which appeared in the Biblical Archaeology Review in the issue of April 1982. And those of you here at college could certainly look at that if you wish in our college library, if you wanted to read it in full. Biblical Archaeology Review, April 1982. Entitled, Is the Biblical Account of the Israelite Conquest of Canaan Historically Reliable? Now, the main thrust of the article is to demolish the opinions of his distinguished colleague, Aharoni, who had a completely different view of the conquest. And I don't want to introduce that idea of Aharoni's into the discussion now. It only will muddy the waters. I just want to quote his summary as to how he sees the conquest. And I want you to note certain things that I tend to emphasize. Not in the sense of writing it, but make a mental note, because I'm going to come back to it in short order, very short order, when I read the next article. All archaeologists agree that at the end of the Late Bronze Age, you know, approximately 1225 BC, the material culture we associate with this period abruptly stopped. That's a very definitive statement. He is saying there is a cultural break, a very definite, clear, unambiguous cultural break, where the culture that had existed in Canaan throughout the Middle Bronze Age and the entire Late Bronze Age came to an abrupt halt, and something completely different replaced it. Now, this is a very important statement he's making. Late Bronze agriculture was based on fortified, read that as walled, city-states. At the end of the period, many of these cities were destroyed. The archaeological evidence shows conflagrations and destructions which cannot be attributed to famine or earthquake. Sometime later, that is, in a later archaeological stratum, a new and completely different culture developed, sometimes on the destroyed site and sometimes on a new site. This new culture, called Iron Age culture, was initially rather poor architecturally. So poor, it could hardly be called urban. This culture appears to reflect the first efforts at settlement by a semi-nomadic people. While this is the general pattern, certain destroyed sites were rebuilt immediately with fortifications and the attributes of a proper city. The fact is that excavation results from the last 50 years or so support in a most amazing way, except in some cases to be mentioned later, the basic historicity of the biblical account. Now, he uses notice that he doesn't say the historicity. You notice what he didn't say. The archaeology does not support the historicity of the biblical account, but the basic historicity. How much of a qualification is that? Well, this is something we need to take a look at. The biblical narrative in broad outline tells us that at a certain period, nomadic Israelites attacked the city-state organization of the Holy Land, destroying many cities and setting them on fire. Then slowly but surely, the Israelites replaced these cities with new unfortified cities or settlements. At the same time, they attempted to occupy certain cities, but were unsuccessful. Here he's talking about Judges chapter 1, which has a listing in that chapter of particular cities the Israelites tried to occupy and could not do so. I don't want to give you a list of them. We will take up some of them a little later. The residents of those cities continued to live side by side with the new invaders. As already indicated, this description, leaving out the words Canaanite or Israelite, is exactly the picture which the archaeological finds present to us. A complete system of fortified cities collapsed and was replaced by a new culture whose material aspect can be defined as the first efforts of semi-nomads to settle down. I do not wish to be misunderstood as arguing that the archaeological record is absolutely consistent with the biblical record, and that excavation results raise no problem whatsoever. What I am saying is that in its broad outline, the archaeological record supports the narrative in Joshua and Judges, as Albright said. I think it would be a mistake to argue that the entire conquest account in Joshua's and Judges is historically accurate in every detail on the one side, or that on the other side it's historically worthless. But in broad outline, if you don't insist on complete fidelity with the biblical account, you could say the two match. Now that is his conclusion. I believe that Albright's approach is correct in its broad outline, though not necessarily its details. And again, with Albright, we must examine the biblical evidence open-mindedly, which means, what does that mean? With a willingness to correct it, you see. That's what open-mindedly means. And compare it with the archaeological evidence in each case without prejudice or bias or any preconceived notion. Where we find agreement between the biblical narrative and the archaeological evidence, there is no reason to doubt the historicity of that particular biblical source. On the other hand, with the archaeological evidence bluntly contradicts the biblical narrative, as it sometimes does. As it sometimes does. I'll come back to that phrase a little later, as to why you understand later I'm stressing it. We should examine the possibility that that particular chapter in the Bible is either ideological, which means there's no basis for it in fact, it was a story made up later to account for something that they couldn't explain. So they made up some sort of fanciful explanation for it. Or a later interpolation, an editorial gloss. Somebody stuck something in the text that didn't belong. Let us not be dogmatic. Let us not try to find a solution which will satisfy or reconcile all the sources in the Bible. Yet at the same time, let us not dismiss out of hand the basic historiographic approach of the Bible, which I believe is fully confirmed by archaeological excavations. That there was a phase in the late Bronze Age in which Israelite nomads, like nomads from other parts of the country, managed to attack the decadent Canaanite settlements. These nomads then slowly but surely moved into the next phase in Israel's history, the sedentary settlement of the tribes in the country on the ruins of the earlier Canaanite cities. I was quoting from pages, I've wiped out the page numbers I put on my own in this handout, so I can't tell you which page it was of the article. But I think it's the second and third page of the text of the article from the Biblical Archaeology Review. Sounds decent, doesn't it? Sounds very fair. The Bible is essentially correct, though not in every detail. If we can say broadly correct. Okay, he's an authority, right? Should we doubt him? He wrote that in 1982. There's an article that came out at about the same time that has quite a different approach. This one is by J. Maxwell Miller. I checked up on him, by the way. He does teach at Emory University. He is chairman of their Department of Religion. Emory University is in Atlanta, Georgia. It appeared in the Palestine Exploration Quarterly. I'm sorry I cannot give you the complete citation. The assistant that I had that year failed to put down the date, and it's not contained anywhere in the article. But I think if you use an index, you probably can locate it. It was entitled Archaeology and the Israelite Conquest of Canaan, Some Methodological Observations. Now, the main thrust of the article is not what concerns me. He's trying to make a particular point in the article which is not of interest to me right now. But what is of interest to me is what he says in the beginning part of his article, and I'd like to quote it. Albright's proposed correlation of biblical and archaeological data, remember that's what Yadin said, was essentially correct. He agrees with Albright. He's got it right. Essentially, you can harmonize it if you're not too insistent on the picky details being exactly as written. This is what Miller says. Albright's proposed correlation of biblical and archaeological data in terms of a 13th century BCE Exodus conquest has served as a standard working hypothesis, especially among English-speaking scholars, since the late 1930s. That is, as artifactual data relevant to the end of the Late Bronze Age have continued to accumulate from Palestinian sites. Now notice this. The inclination has been to attribute any approximately 13th century city destruction to the Israelite invaders. There's been an inclination to take any evidence of a city destroyed in Canaan at approximately the 13th century, late 13th century, Israelite responsibility. That has been the inclination. Regardless of whether the city in question is even mentioned in the biblical conquest traditions. When excavations at the cities which do figure in the conquest traditions have yielded little or no late bronze remains, this negative evidence has been explained away in one fashion or another. Actually, some of the archaeological evidence which was available during the 1930s, especially that from Jericho and Ai, was already then rather damaging to Albright's position. And not all of the archaeological arguments which he was able to marshal in support of a 13th century Exodus conquest have survived the test of time. And here's the real stinger. Finally, we have reached the point, it seems to me, where more archaeological evidence must be explained away in order to maintain Albright's position, then can be called upon to support it. In other words, if you look at the archaeological evidence that has accumulated since the time of Albright, connected with this century, and weigh it with his theory, you have less that supports it than has to be explained away. It's not the little bit that doesn't seem to fit you have to explain away, it's the majority. Now notice what he says, and I'll summarize it later on this chart. You don't have to try to get it all down. Briefly, the archaeological situation at the cities which figure prominently in the conquest tradition is as follows. Hormuth, Arad, Heshbon, Jericho, Ai, Gibeon, Yarmouth have yielded little or no evidence of even having been occupied during the Late Bronze, much less of having been destroyed during the 13th century. Jerusalem, Hebron, and Debir appeared to have been occupied during the late Bronze Iron I transition, but there is no indication at any of these places of a major destruction which could be attributed to an Israelite invasion. Bethel was occupied and destroyed more than once during the late Bronze Iron I, but the Bible conspicuously excludes Bethel from Joshua's conquests. Eglon has been associated with Tel El-Hesi, but there is little to recommend the identification, which leaves only Lachish and Hazor. Here, finally, are two cities which the Bible claims to have been conquered by Joshua and where archaeological remains could be interpreted in terms of a 13th century conquest. Not a very high percentage. Notice then, when we go to the list, Arad in the late Bronze 2B, the time when Albright said the conquest occurred, did not exist. Hormah did not exist. Heshbon did not exist. While the problem with Jericho in the late Bronze 1 is that the city existed but wasn't destroyed, the problem in the late Bronze 2B, where Albright wants to put the conquest, the city was unoccupied. That doesn't improve on the situation at all. You just have the other ditch that you've just jumped into. The Bible says emphatically that Jericho was destroyed, and here there is no city there. Ai did not exist. Gibeon did not exist. Jerusalem did exist. He admits that. I don't know why. He seems to want to find evidence of a destruction there. I don't know why. Because it does not mention in Joshua's account that they attacked Jerusalem. And even in the book of Judges, it says that the tribe of Judah tried to take Jerusalem and failed, and the tribe of Benjamin tried to take Jerusalem and failed. So I don't know why he would expect to find destruction at Jerusalem. It sort of bewilders me. But the point is, at least it existed. Hebron, what does he say about Hebron? He says, Hebron and Debir appear to have been occupied during the late Bronze Iron One, but there is no indication that there was a major destruction at that place. Yet Joshua says he destroyed Hebron and Debir. So there again we have a problem, is we have a continued existence in both of these places when the Bible says they should have been destroyed. Finally, in the case of Lachish, we have a destruction. Yarmouth, again, he doesn't even mention. He does mention Yarmouth. He doesn't mention Libna, but he does mention Yarmouth and Eglon. And he says the identifications are probably poor, so we can't say much there. But Hazor we can find a match for also. So in the list of cities, are we any better off in matching the archaeological record and the biblical account by moving the conquest from the end of the late Bronze I to the late Bronze IIb, moving it from 1400 B.C., which is the biblical date, to 1225? No. We have the same matches, Jerusalem, Lachish, Hazor. But we also have some additional problems. These problems begin to crop up. Albright himself was very unhappy with the fact that he could not get his information at Bethel, which he felt, remember, had been destroyed by Joshua, to match with the information at Lachish. And I'd like to quote from what Albright's, I think I've got a complete quote. Let's see. What he wrote about Bethel, he says, he found, and I'm quoting now, a tremendous conflagration marking a complete break from the late Bronze and the Iron Age strata. It is so complete, he wrote, and again I'm quoting, that no bridge can be thrown across it. We are compelled to identify it with the Israelite conquest. The problem is that he dated this destruction of Bethel to the first half of the 13th century B.C. That means somewhere between 1299 and 1250. Somewhere between 1299 and 1250, Bethel was destroyed. Don't laugh. The problem with that is that the destruction of Lachish was dated about 1225. There was at least a 25-year gap between the destruction of Bethel and the destruction of Lachish. And yet one doesn't get that impression from the biblical narrative that the conquest took that long to accomplish. That was disturbing enough, even in Albright's day. And the excavators at Lachish put a lot of pressure on Albright. Couldn't you lower that date? Couldn't you bring it down closer to Lachish? And he did bring it down. He eventually did bring it down to just about 1250. His last published comment said, well, I think I could pinpoint it at about 1250. But he just wouldn't go beyond that. And that still left a 25-year gap. Now, that's pretty bad, but it gets worse. Lachish has been re-excavated. In fact, the excavation is still going on. Those who have gone with me in the last several years to Israel have sometimes even seen the process of excavation taking place. At other times, they've just been viewing the site, which is currently being worked. And the problem is that they have, based on new evidence at Lachish, have arrived at a completely new date for the destruction, the last Canaanite city of Lachish to be destroyed. And that new date for Lachish's destruction is approximately 1140 B.C. Therefore, we now have not just a 25-year gap between the destruction of Bethel and Lachish, which are supposed to be part of the same conquest. We have a 110-year gap. Are we talking about the same event? Obviously not. You cannot link the destruction of Bethel and Lachish together. It's too far down. And the same thing can be said of Hazor. Hazor, the latest you could date the destruction of Hazor is 1225. That's the latest you could date it. So again, you've got a tremendous gap between the date for the destruction of Canaanite Lachish and the date for the destruction of Hazor. You are not talking about the same thing at all. This is why many scholars began to talk about multiple conquests, separate groups of Israelite tribes, unrelated to each other, sweeping into the country at different times, only later amalgamating themselves together into a 12-tribe confederacy. And why 12 tribes? Not because they were 12 sons of Jacob, but because they agreed to worship the same God and to share a common sanctuary. And if they were going to share a common sanctuary, it made sense everybody had to be responsible for it a certain period of the year. So they had a 12-month calendar, so they divided themselves up into 12 groups, so each group would have 1 month of responsibility for the sanctuary. Very nice, but there's no such proof at all. It's all theoretical in the realm of ivory tower speculation. But this is the process that went on. But there are other problems with this view of a late date, which are introduced. The whole book of the Judges, which according to the biblical chronology, is supposed to stretch from the time of Joshua's conquest, or let's say his death, I'm sorry, which let's assume that he died about 20-some years later, let's say 1375 B.C., down to the time of Saul's kingship of approximately 1050 B.C. We have 325 years that the book of the Judges must cover, from approximately the death of Joshua until the time of Saul, around 1375, and I may be a little too low for his death, to around 1050, I'm rounding it off. Dr. Hay would say 1047 for Saul's kingship. So from the death of Joshua to the kingship of Saul, we have approximately 325 years that the book of Judges covers. But if these people are correct and the conquest took place in 1225, then Joshua must have died around 1200. We have to compress the 325 years has to be compressed into what space? From around 1200 down to 1050. 150 years. If you take 325 years of the book of Judges and reduce it to half its length, but it's more complicated than just that. You see, it's very clear that a large part of the book of the Judges deals with the material related to their struggle with the Philistines. Everything in the book of Judges mentioned before Samson must occur before the conflict with the Philistines. Now, the struggle with the Philistines began around the year 1100 or 1125. So then everything prior to Samson has to be compressed between around 1200 and 1100 at the latest, in 100 years. And you just can't compress all that material that easily. It just distorts the whole structure of the book of the Judges. And that's not the only problem with the book of the Judges. The next problem would be made clear, I think, from this handout, which I want to distribute. Let's see if we can understand the additional problem caused by this modern critical approach of putting the Exodus in the late 13th century in terms specifically of Hazor. And what you have in the form of this handout is an archaeological profile of Hazor. Now, there's lots of detail here. Most of it is irrelevant to the purposes of this class. But it's something I already had prepared, and it will serve the purpose I wish to make use of it in this class, and that's why I'm using it. If the modern critics are correct, and Hazor, which was destroyed around 1225 B.C., is the destruction of Joshua, we have created for ourselves another major biblical problem. Let us see what the nature of that problem is. Now, in the This is arranged like a tell. The more recent levels are at the top, the earlier ones are at the bottom. So to read it, to go progressively through time, we have to read up. The city was destroyed, so they say, by Joshua at approximately 1225. Now, the archaeological investigation of Hazor reveals that following that destruction, there was a gap in occupation. There was a period of time when no one lived on the site. Then in sometime in the 1100s B.C., probably the early 1100s, which means around 1190, 1180, something on that order, there was a small settlement, foundations for tents and huts, pottery similar to that of the hills of Galilee. And from the types of pottery that are found and the nature of the architecture, it is concluded that this was an Israelite settlement in among the ruins of formerly Canaanite Hazor. During the thousands B.C., you'll notice, again, there was still a limited settlement. No town planning is evidenced, and the whole complex was unfortified. Okay, looking at the chart again, we have then the presumption that Joshua destroyed the city in 1225, and that if the first resettlement, that very small settlement in the what's called level 12 on the chart, is Israelite, a very primitive Israelite village, which is succeeded eventually by a formal, well-planned Israelite city at the time of Solomon, there is never again a Canaanite occupation of the site. That from the time of Joshua to Solomon, there is either nothing at the site or it is only Israelite. What then do we do with Judges chapter 4? Judges chapter 4 tells us that because of her sins, Israel was sold into the hand of Jabin, the king of Hazor, who oppressed the Israelites. And Deborah, working with Barak as her general, fought against the Canaanite forces in the Jezreel Valley and delivered Israel from this oppression. Where is this Canaanite city that Deborah's forces had to oppose? It doesn't exist anywhere in the record. Therefore, we are compelled to throw Judges 4 out of the Bible, or at least the mention of Hazor out of the Bible. So we've created another problem for ourselves. Now, as a parenthetical statement, let me just say that Professor Benjamin Mazar, followed by Aharoni, decided to adopt a very novel solution to the problem, and that was to reverse the order of Deborah and Joshua. That Deborah really carried out her campaign before Joshua, not several hundred years later. That makes even more of a hash of the biblical material. Now, well, how does this square with what Yadin says? That in broad outline, the Bible and the archaeology agree very well. You have to be very broad to say you have that much agreement. You have mostly non-agreement. You know, this is really ridiculous to call this any kind of agreement at all. And so the problem continues to befuddle people that are searching for the answer, what in the world happened when Israel invaded Canaan? Because the fact that Israel, or at least a part of Israel, was in Egypt, no one disputes, except for one man who everybody, despite his distinguished reputation, everybody ridicules. He teaches at the University of Arizona in Tucson, William Deaver. He served as a vice president of the American Schools of Oriental Research, a very prestigious position. But he came to the conclusion, which was published just last spring, that there was no Egyptian captivity. There was no Exodus. It's all fictional. But as somebody observed at the conference I attended last spring, and this found agreement across the board. Traditionalists, even the wackiest modern critics, would have agreed with this statement that was said. What kind of a people invents a history for itself like that? That they were once a slave people in another country and came out there and after many wanderings came to their new home. What kind of a history is that to invent out of whole cloth? It doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Makes no sense at all. But he got so frustrated in trying to reconcile all this, he just gave up entirely and said the whole thing is fiction. But nobody is willing to follow him that far. What have they done then with this material? They've gone off in many different directions. There is now no consensus as to how to reconcile even a modicum of the biblical account with the archaeological evidence. And probably today, the leading theories are as follows. One, that there was a conquest, but that the biblical narrative is only coincidentally reflecting the true facts. But the biblical narrative was written hundreds of years later, and it was a best attempt to explain how the process took place. And therefore, it is hopelessly inaccurate in terms of the details. That's one view. There are two things that shake that view very strongly. One, if it was an account written hundreds of years later, attempting to account for a process of which they had no specific knowledge, why wasn't it written as a very general account? Why is it written with all these specific details? That seems a funny approach to take if you have only a hazy recollection of what happened. Why would you write a recollection that is so specific in detail? You'd be better off just writing a generalized account and getting it covered in a few quick sentences. It's a very funny approach to take. And the second problem is this. The biblical account speaks specifically of Israel facing and destroying a large number of walled cities. For instance, in Numbers chapter 13, you have the report of the spies, right? What is it they tell the people? Besides the people are giants, what do they tell them? They dwell in these very powerful, strongly walled cities. We can never conquer these cities. And of course, it's only Joshua and Caleb said, strong as they are, with God, we can do it. That's the essence of their response. Nothing's impossible with God. Let's not be afraid. But the fact emerges from the latest research, so late, it was only presented to a full public as recently as the conference I attended last spring, and was met by a tremendous gasp by the audience. This research was undertaken by an Israeli scholar. Her name is Rivka, which means just a Hebrew version of Rebecca. Rivka Gonen, G-O-N-E-N. And on the basis of her research, and I have no reason to doubt it, neither did anyone else at the conference, it was very carefully done, the late Bronze Age was one of the least urbanized in the entire history of Canaan. That following the destruction of the cities at the end of the Middle Bronze Age, most, if not all, of these cities remained unoccupied for either part or all of the late Bronze period. And that almost every place that was resettled was unfortified. That she is saying that in the late Bronze Age, those cities that were reoccupied after the massive destructions that took place at the end of the Middle Bronze period, almost without exception, had no walls. How can we reconcile that situation, which seems grounded in fact, I have no reason to doubt it, with the mention of the spies of these horribly fortified cities? How does that even come close to an approximation between the archaeology and the biblical account? In fact, she says, to give you some statistics, that after the end of the Middle Bronze Age, fully 63% of the Middle Bronze sites were unoccupied. Only 37% were refounded in the late Bronze Age. And in the hill country, it's even more dramatic. And that's significant. because this is where Joshua's campaign was centered, was the hill country. But after the Middle Bronze Age, 95% of the sites were never rebuilt during the Late Bronze period. So where are all these threatening cities dotting the landscape everywhere that so scared the spies and that Joshua had to campaign against so energetically? How do you make any congruence between these two accounts? You can't. This has given new life to another theory. They said the first theory was the idea that this was a hazy recollection. That's all. There was a conquest, but the details were forgotten, and somebody hundreds of years later tried to write a history of it and goofed. It doesn't seem there's any correspondence at all, in this period anyway. The other alternative is to go back to a theory proposed by Albrecht Alt, A-L-T, and Martin Note, N-O-T-H, Albrecht Alt and Martin Note. This was proposed in the early years of the 20th century, developed, that there was no conquest at the first. The Israelites infiltrated from the desert into the central hill country, which, remember, Gonin's evidence showed was 95% empty. Only 5% of the Middle Bronze sites had even been reconstructed in the Late Bronze Age, where they had therefore very little resistance. And they settled down in a sort of semi-nomadic way. Then, after several hundred years, they began to become more sedentary, and that brought them into conflict with the Canaanite neighbors, and they had to fight the Canaanite cities and destroy them. And this, then, is the nature of the conquest. A period of peaceful infiltration, of semi-nomadic lifestyle, followed after a period of hundreds of years by gradually settling down and then coming into conflict with their Canaanite neighbors in a way that caused the destruction of various cities. Indeed, Gonin's evidence would seem to support this. She mentions that between 1400 B.C. and 1200 B.C., you see a gradual rise in settlements, accelerating in the period between 1300 and 1000. I'm sorry, accelerating between 1200 and 1000. Between 1200 and 1000. For example, in southern Samaria, in the southern hills of Samaria, at the end of the Late Bronze Age, there were five settlements. At the end of the Iron One period, around the year 1000, there were 103 in southern Samaria alone. They all share the same kind of pottery. They all share the same kind of architecture, which we later identify as Israelite. And what is interesting about these settlements is they are clustered in the beginning between Shechem and Shiloh. Between Shechem and Shiloh, or Shiloh, as many of you like to pronounce it. And they spread outward from that region until they spread into the Galilee, to the hills of Judah, and eventually down into the area around Beersheba and the foothill region. This theory has been modified by a man by the name of Norman Gottwald, G-O-T-T-W-A-L-D. He is not an archaeologist. He is not a biblical historian. He cannot read Hebrew. He cannot read any of the ancient languages. He is a sociologist. But he has attempted to understand the process of Israel's takeover of Canaan in sociological terms. And his theory, which has become the new wave, rage, you might say, the new fad, is that there were very few Israelites who even came in and settled. That what happened is at the end of the Middle Bronze Age, when these cities were destroyed, the peasants who had been held in a feudal type subjection by their Canaanite overlords revolted, and it was these Canaanite peasants who joined with the Israelites to become the Israelite nation. But basically, the origins of Israelite are basically the indigenous population of Canaan, with a small group that came out of Egypt with the worship of Yahweh as their God. And that these people, that these peasants that revolted from their Canaanite overlords, they accepted the God of this new group. And Joshua 24, the covenant that is contained there, is a glimmering of this historic pact between the native Canaanite population and the Israelite arrivals from Egypt, where they all pledge themselves to the worship of Yahweh. This is the new way. Okay, we'll end there. Next time I will give you a look at a dramatic new approach, the Bimson thesis.